loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we turn to the U.K. The government of Britain has announced that they have identified the people who they say poison the Skripals. We'll take a closer look at the evidence that's being presented and how the whole story adds up and the political implications inside of the UK, inside of Europe, and between the UK and Russia and the United States and Russia. And then it's Wednesday, so we continue our regular Wednesday segment called Beyond Nuclear, where we look at nuclear issues, including nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, nuclear waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States with Beyond Nuclear Radioactive Waste Watchdog, Kevin Camps.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the intelligence services of the Five Eyes countries, the U.S., the U.K., Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, are quietly warning technology firms that they want access to all encrypted emails, text messages, and voice communications, and they are threatening to compel the companies to give it to them if they don't do so voluntarily. Next, legendary Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward has a new book coming out. Fear, Trump in the White House will be released on Tuesday, but leaked passages are already making the news. They portray the White House as a veritable killing field of political careers and a president who is unhinged, unpredictable, and obsessed with the Mueller investigation. That might ring true, but Woodward has a history of embellishing and, in some cases, just making things up. Then Amazon yesterday hit a market valuation of $1 trillion, only the second company in the world to reach that number besides Apple. Founder Jeff Bezos is the world's wealthiest man at $165 billion. All the while, many of his employees work for minimum wage and qualify for food stamps. And then Capitol Hill is buzzing with the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. Republicans laud Kavanaugh's supposed mainstream Republican views, while Democrats complain that the nomination would tilt the court further to the left, especially on social issues. But what neither side is talking about is Kavanaugh's well-documented opposition to net neutrality. And finally, Democratic insurgent Diana Presley, a Boston City Council member, defeated 10-term incumbent Mike Capuano yesterday in a hotly contested Democratic primary in Massachusetts. The upset is another indication that the Democratic Party rank and file are angry, motivated, and getting out the vote. And in other headlines, talks between the United States and Canada over the future of the North American Free Trade Agreement resumed today. While the United States and Mexico have reached a breakthrough, U.S.-Canadian relations have been strained. The two sides are aiming to complete the negotiations by the end of September. Under intense international pressure, the government of Qatar announced today that it will no longer require foreign workers to get the permission of their employer before leaving the country. Permission to exit is one of the key components of the kafala labor system popular in the Gulf states that critics describe as a form of slavery. Qatar's labor policy is under special scrutiny due to the preparations underway for the country to host the 2022 World Cup. The Israeli Defense Force has confirmed to the Jerusalem Post that they in fact provided weapons and aid to Islamist rebel insurgents in Syria's Golan Heights. The article, which was shared around on social media, was then deleted several hours later without any explanation. The Golan Heights is an area in southwestern Syria that was annexed by Israel and has been occupied since the 1967 Middle East War. The government of Spain announced that it will end a controversial sale of missiles to Saudi Arabia, citing abuses by the country in its war on Yemen. The deal, signed in 2015, would have involved 400 guided missiles. Spain is joining Sweden, Canada, Norway, Finland, Belgium, and Germany, which have already canceled weapons deals with Saudi Arabia. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the fallout from the Skripal case. The British government has charged two Russian nationals, whom it describes as military intelligence assassins, with attempted murder in the poisoning last spring of former Russian double agent Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia. Both survived. Scotland Yard investigators claim to have found traces of Novichok, a weapons-grade nerve agent, in a perfume bottle that the two allegedly used on the victims. Both Russians are said by the British government to be in Moscow. We're joined from Sheffield, England, by Dr. Piers Robinson. He's the chairman of the Politics, Society, and Political Journalism Department at the University of Sheffield. And we're joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. He is the editor of the polemicist.net. Piers Robinson and Jim Kavanaugh, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thanks for having me.
Hi there.
Dr. Robinson, you're there. You're in the UK. This was a dramatic presentation by Prime Minister Theresa May. There's a lot to talk about this. And of course, I think what's being presented, I heard a little bit of BBC about Theresa May's speech, and I'm looking at the American media, and you can't but help come to the conclusion that the main narrative there is case closed, the Russians did it, here's the proof, here's the timeline, here's the itinerary of the assassins. Again, case closed. But at least for us, there's a lot that needs to be unpacked and a lot that needs to be answered as we explore not only what happened here, but some of the politics that are involved in the Skripal case, both internal British politics and then politics between Britain and Russia and between the United States and Russia and between Europe and Russia. So anyway, you're there. What's the mood and what was your own take on these new announcements?
Well, I'm actually in Berlin at the moment, but I have been following the story, obviously. Quite clearly, the claims or the allegations put forward by Theresa May today in the Commons is are very clear and very unambiguous. And the way this is likely to play politically in the UK is the way that it has played before in relation to the initial poisoning of the Skripals, where you have consensus emerging very, very, very quickly, certainly in the political establishment, certainly in the mainstream media, that it is case closed, as you suggested. Now, I don't know how long that will necessarily play for, because the British government has made a very clear allegation against the Russian government. At the moment, the police are not actually fully backing that up. They're saying that they are looking for two Russian nationals, but they have not gone further in the way the British government has and made claim that these are actually Russian agents and it has been authorized by the Russian state. So interestingly, you've got a kind of well, not necessarily an overclaim, but you have Theresa May making claims which go much further than the evidence which is being discussed by the police. And this is a similar pattern we saw when the poisonings first happened back in April, is that you had an allegation that the Russians were responsible, or a strong suggestion that they were, and you then had the expelling of diplomats, and you had very clear claims coming from the British government that it was Novichok, that it could only have been produced, or suggesting it could only have been produced in Russia. And very quickly, sort of, that was debunked, and people realized that, well, it wasn't necessarily produced in Russia. And you had a much more questioning atmosphere emerging. Now, whether that's going to happen here now in this situation, we'll have to wait and see. But we certainly have Theresa May and the British government, you know, really making pretty bold allegations again and actually asking us effectively to trust them, to trust the intelligence services. And we're going to have to see how that plays. I suspect that when people such as myself and others have time to actually start to look at the evidence and look at the facts, that more questions might well arise. We already have questions still persisting from the original poisoning, questions surrounding sort of how the nerve agent could have been applied to a door handle and then for it to act so many hours later at exactly the same time on two people. That's a big question which needs to be explored. But we might find that we have questions. We have questions about what is now being claimed and being put forward in terms of the timeline. And what we need to do is to sort of actually drill down and ask those questions. But the political mood and the drive from the sort of anti-Russian brigade will be to really capitalize on this as much as possible in order to, you know, point the finger at Russia, reinforce the sort of general Russian, anti-Russian narrative, which has prevailed in certain quarters of the British political sphere and also the Western political sphere for some time. I'm suspecting there's going to be questions which are going to bubble up to the surface again. They probably already are to day. I've been tracking what some people have been saying in interviews. There are already some questions. Some people are asking yet again the question of what exactly is the motivation here for the Russian government to have carried out this attack that's being alleged. That's very, very unclear at this point in time. I suspect more questions will arise and we'll see where we go. We'll look at rationally at the information and try to get to the bottom, to the truth of what's going on here.
Jim Kavanaugh, when I was listening to this BBC report, this was many hours ago, the host was asking, I think it was a BBC political analyst or somebody functioning in that capacity, and the question was, would Theresa May have gone and made this dramatic speech without and stake this strong position out if the evidence wasn't clear-cut, wasn't unambiguous? And the answer was no. And that, in a way, sort of answered the question, is there proof? And the proof is that Theresa May would not have said it if there wasn't proof, because it's such a high-stakes and high-profile way that the presentation is made. That's it, in a way. You know, what Piers was saying, for us, for John and I, have been talking about this not only today, but for weeks.
Yes.
Like, what is the motivation? What would the motivation have been? Putin was running for re-election. He was going to win. At that very moment, the Russian government sends Russian intelligence agencies to publicly assassinate a double agent, a British double agent who had worked once for Russian intelligence, who they had let go out of prison. He was sentenced to like 13 years. They let him go after 4 years. He was living peacefully in England. Why, at that moment, as Putin was in this high-profile election, would they go and try to poison somebody with a nerve agent, which was only produced in Russia or in the former Soviet Union? In other words, a very traceable use of a weapon. And it didn't succeed. Like, why not just stab him in the back alley where, you know, like you just want to, if you really, truly want to kill somebody? It just didn't add up.
And before you answer that question, let me add something. As an intelligence officer for 15 years, I can tell you that no intelligence organization worth its weight would send two assassins together on the same plane to then return the same day on a regularly scheduled flight. No one in his right mind would do something like that. What you do is you have somebody come in by train from France, you have somebody else come in by boat from Ireland, or, you know, on a bus, or maybe one flies into Luton or something. You don't just put people on a plane together and have them fly into Heathrow and get their luggage together and then go do a hit and then go back to the airport. That's from the movies. That doesn't happen in real life.
Yeah. Jim Kavanaugh, from the movies.
Wouldn't even be a good movie, as you say.
No, it wouldn't, frankly.
It wouldn't be any fun in it. I mean, as you say, that really struck me right away. You know, these guys just traveling through airports together. Everybody knows there are cameras everywhere. I mean, and, you know, as you, but your point about, you know, if Theresa May said it, must be right. Well, they already had to walk back the first statements they made about the Skripal poisoning when they said this could only be made in Russia. And then they had to kind of walk that back a little bit. So he's already, the British government in this case, has already said things they've had to walk back. You know, it's just the case that they have made very specific allegations here again, like they did at that time, that this could only be made in Russia. That turned out not to be true. Here they have two people who seem to be Russian, although they're aliases, we don't know their real names. They have a very specific itinerary. They can show them walking around. So it suggests an association with this crime that has yet to be proven. That's all there is to it. You know, let's by all means investigate this. But one cannot assume that the investigation is already over and that they're guilty. You know, sentence first, verdict afterwards. This is what's going on. And it is, you know, it's, let's find out what happened. It's interesting to me, and it's kind of bizarre. I cannot imagine, as you say, what the Russian government's motivation for this would be. There may be Russian nationals who would have motivation for going after the Skripals. There was one guy, I saw this once, and it was online. There's a friend of the Skripals, of Sergei Skripal, who said right after the first incident, you know, I knew this guy. He was going to the Russian consulate all the time to talk to the Russians. He was friendly with the Russian government. You know, he might have been working as some kind of liaison with MI6 in Russia at the time. I mean, so that's never come out again. I don't know. So I don't know what the Russian government would have on this, but there are, you know, 100 Russian oligarchs and who might have something out for Sergei Skripal. I don't know.
Piers, let's talk about who might have another motive, because as a consequence of this public poisoning, supposedly with Novichok, only made, as we were told earlier, in the Soviet Union or Russia, Britain expelled a lot of diplomats from Russia. Russia retaliated. The Trump administration expelled a lot of Russian diplomats. There were very heavy new sanctions. There was a sort of a a creation of an additional wave of animus and hostility against Putin and economic and political sanctions. There are Russian dissidents against Putin who are also operating in the UK. If you look at who's benefiting from all of this, might some of them be actually benefiting from this? Would any of them have a motive in staging an attack like this? And not that we can know, but just hypothetically, go ahead.
Well, hypothetically, yes, it could well be the case that, you know, Russians who are opposed to Putin, who are seeking a way to discredit Putin, might be involved in this. I think the more immediate line of inquiry, which was worthwhile for journalists, mainstream and alternative, and from Russia Today and anywhere else, worth looking at, is the question of Sergei Skripal's handler, Pablo Miller. And Pablo Miller, D-notice was served on him shortly after the poisoning, preventing British journalists from reporting on the fact that Skripal had a relationship with Pablo Miller. And of course, Pablo Miller was part of, I think, Orbis Intelligence, which was Christopher Steele's worked for. And as we know, Steele has been implicated in the Trump dossier. And so you have questions surrounding that. And as soon as you understand that, then clearly sort of a variety of actors with potential motives might be coming into play here, which you need to seriously consider. And also, you know, given the scale and the political importance of what's happened in relation to the Trump dossier, what's going on in America, Steele's involvement in it, etc., and the connection there with Skripal, means that this is an obvious area that sort of any police officer worth his or her soul would actually seek to investigate and to look at. So I think that's a possibility. And at the moment, you know, the mode there seem to be stronger motives that you can think through rationally coming from, okay, either a Russian dissident or from somebody connected in some way with the production of that dossier than there is in relation to Putin. Everyone wants to sort of be completely objective about, you know, who has the strongest motives for what's going on. And so I would say that if I was to make any recommendation to any journalist, any investigative journalist, it would be to look very, very closely at that relationship, because obviously that throws up an awful lot of questions as to what was going on.
Wasn't there a similar case with Shenko where it was blamed on the Russian government, and then it turned out it was much more likely to have been one of his Russian rivals?
Yes, and that happens all the time. And that's why we have to ask ourselves about investigatory procedure. You know, everybody knows that the likeliest person to commit a crime is the person who had means, motive, and opportunity. Well, certainly the Russian government had the means and the opportunity, but what was the motive? There doesn't seem to be any logical motive here. Now, there are certainly motives for others to have done something like this. And it also seems to me, and of course I'm just speculating because I don't have any inside information at all, but it seems to me that if Novichok is as ungodly deadly as everybody says it is, that if you're, you know, just in its presence, you'll die instantly. Why is it that so many people have survived this already?
Yeah, the GRU is a kind of amateurish organization, and they can't make good poison. I mean, it doesn't kill people. It's very strange. But what it shows is the need for investigative reporting, as Pierce has said, and what these statements from the British government and what the media is doing is kind of trying to stop people from doing that. So we already know the answer. There's no reason to go any further. And if you ask any questions about it, that just means you're a Putin, you know, you're a Putin apologist.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The sort of the attempt to close down the questioning is phenomenal at the moment. You know, if you do question, you're accused of being a Putin apologist, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this is remarkable, that the ferocity with which those allegations and charges are made at people asking straightforward questions. I would say that it's really important, and I said this at the time, that when the Skripal poisoning occurred, we knew we were running up to a major military operation in Syria by the Syrian government in order to regain territory in Ghouta. And we know that there was an alleged chemical weapons attack, and there was a bombing air raid associated with that coming from France, Britain, and America. And we are here again at a point of major military confrontation potentially between Russia, the Syrian government, and the Americans and the West over Syria, with possibly the final battle in Syria. And I do think it's important to keep in mind is that, you know, whilst we are focusing attention on the claims being made by the British government, we should also be aware as to how this might play out in terms of the broader geopolitical context. And I think my concern would be at this point that sort of whatever the truth behind the Skripal affair, that what happens is that this is exploited politically in the context of what's going on in Syria. So you might well find if there's an alleged chemical weapons attack again in Syria, that this what's happened here with the Skripals and what the British government has claimed will be used to reinforce a particular interpretation, or rather taken advantage of to reinforce a particular interpretation of what's happened in Syria, i.e. that it was a Syrian government with a Russian backing carried out the attack, etc. And I think it's very important when we get sort of this kind of laser focus on these sort of very dramatic events and claims being made that there's a bigger political context out there. And what we do know, you know, political actors exploit events and media attention for other political purposes. And I think that's a real risk, especially given the scale of what's happening in Syria at the moment, especially given the potential that we are at now with either defeat for Western objectives to overthrow the Syrian government or a potential major escalation in Syria, which would take us up against the Russians.
Piers, let me bring out one quick thing for the audience, for at least for our American audience. You mentioned that at the very beginning of the Skripal incident, when they were originally poisoned, that everybody thought they would die. They didn't die, even though the allegation was that this was a military-grade nerve agent. The security services, you said, issued a D-notice barring the media in Britain from the mention of the name Pablo Miller. Again, what's a D-notice? Americans won't know what that is.
Well, a D-notice is actually an informal agreement between media and the government not to cover particular issues, which the government says, well, this is a national security matter and so on. And a D-notice, I mean, it is a voluntary arrangement, but really sort of journalists go with it. And if the government slaps a D-notice on an issue, then they'll be very reluctant to cover that. And that's what the British government did. And that should really be straight away a red flag to any investigative journalist. Think, right, why are they putting a D-notice? Why are they trying to disguise this relationship between these two people? What might be the motivation? And does this tell us anything? So, that's essentially what a D-notice is. It's a way the government can sort of stop or strongly persuade journalists not to cover a particular issue. And that's what they did with Pablo Miller and his relationship to Skripal, really very shortly, I think, after Theresa May's announcement in the Commons, where she strongly suggested the Russians were responsible all the way back in the spring.
Jim Kavanaugh, you know, we're talking about whether this event, which seems like, or is at least being presented in the British media and in the American media as case closed now, we have the names and the faces of two Russians. They came from Moscow. They went and poisoned the Skripals. They then went back. They were seen on CCTV. They went back to the airport. They got in the same plane again together, case closed. And Piers is making the point that we should be also aware or alert to, and we don't want to necessarily engage in conspiracy theories, but there are events that take place where everyone is convinced that it's case closed. And those become pretexts for some other military or political operation. The sinking of the battleship Maine in the harbor in Havana was the pretext that was needed for the U.S. to go into Cuba for the Spanish-American War. There was the Gulf of Tonkin, which turned out to be, you know, not true. North Vietnam did not attack an American destroyer. We have, you know, we have many, many instances where, a pretext has been presented to sort of inaugurate some other political activity. Certainly, we're not going to war with Russia right now, but what Piers is saying is that this sort of growing sort of indictment of Russia by Britain and joined in by the United States and around the issue of chemical weapons could be pretextual, and we hear lots of noises about chemical weapons as the pretext for the intervention now by the American government in Syria. Again, at the very moment that the rebels who are backed by the United States are losing, they're in their last stronghold in Idlib. Anyway, do you give any credence to this, to that kind of thinking?
it's kind of obvious at this point that these things are, whatever the truth of the matter, they are being used politically for the same purposes. And there is, John Bolton and I think Pompeo also said, you know, if there's an attack in Syria, if they use chemical weapons here, we're going to really strike hard. And Nikki Haley said yesterday, if there's an attack, chemical attack in Syria, we will know who did it. We already know who did it. So they are saying they know in advance of something happening who did it. So this whole kind of thinking that we know who did it, and it's always the Russians or the guys who are, the Syrians and the Russians and the Syrians, it's the Assad apologist or it's the Putin apologist. They are the enemies, and we know that if something bad happens, they're the ones who did it. And that's just sunk in. And it's been accepted so much across the board politically in the political and media establishment that they can get away with it. Before presenting these guys' faces today, which at least is specific evidence, the entire media establishment, political establishment in the United States and Britain assumed that it was true that the Russians had. You have to assume that. You can't talk on the radio and television without being excoriated if you don't assume that the Russians were responsible for this was all for poisoning the Skripals. So this is all, out there already, and it is one big offensive. It's a media offensive, but it's also a very serious sanctions offensive. There's serious economic sanctions now, and it is a potential conflict between the United States and Russia. If the United States decides to launch some kind of very big strike against Damascus, then it's hard to imagine they won't come into conflict with Russia. And they keep provoking the Russians in that case to the point where will they strike back or not? Will they do something? How far can we go in these little bloody nose attacks before the Russians hit back? And if the Russians hit back, then you're in a whole other ballgame. And this is the game they've been playing for 2 years now, and they're pushing and pushing and pushing that. And whatever the truth of this particular Skripal matter is, they are using it to continue and to increase those provocations.
Let me ask Pierce real quickly. We have less than a minute left, Pierce. Tell us a little bit about Mikhail Khodorkovsky. He certainly would benefit from this demonization of Vladimir Putin in the UK, would he not? He's an exile in the UK. He's got $500 million, and he wants to be president of Russia.
I don't want to talk about individuals, it's just him, but the general point is absolutely right. There are many, many people who, and Russian exiles, who would benefit from the demonization of Putin. There's no doubt about that. So, those are the things which we need to be open-minded about and consider when trying to understand what's happened in this particular case. But for sure, a whole number of people have these motives that you describe.
Yeah, and again, I want to urge our audience to just be skeptical right now. If the evidence comes out and it's proof that the Russians in fact did this, okay, let's say so. But right now, what we're being presented with is basically the argument and the impression that the case is closed, and thus all the other things, all the other dominoes must fall with it. More sanctions, more animosity, more hostility, perhaps conflict, maybe even direct conflict in Syria. Again, very, very important for people to remain skeptical and demand answers and to really think things through for themselves. We've been joined from Berlin by Dr. Piers Robinson. Normally, we would be talking to him from Sheffield, England. He's the chairman of Politics, Society, and Political Journalism Department at the University of Sheffield. And we were joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. Jim is the editor of the Polemicist. .net. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. It's Wednesday, so we continue our regular segment called Beyond Nuclear, where we take a look at nuclear issues, including nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, nuclear waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States with Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You can go to find his work and his writings and the work of the group at the website beyondnuclear.org. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. Welcome back, both of you.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Kevin, Mobile Chernobyl, that rhymes, but aside from rhyming, it's kind of a scary concept.
Well, it's a slogan that dates back to the 90s for sure, and it's about high-level radioactive waste transportation risks, and it's a major issue when it comes to all these proposed dump sites. So Yucca Mountain, Nevada, Holtec, New Mexico, Waste Control Specialist, Texas. What makes it everybody's problem is the high-level radioactive waste transportation. Everybody lives in Nevada, New Mexico, and Texas. When they start ramming this stuff through by the thousands of shipments, by truck, by train, by barge, through most states in the lower 48, many major cities, and the vast majority of U.S. congressional districts.
44 states, in fact.
Very few are exempted. I mean, states like North Dakota happens to be exempted because of their geographic location. But even states that don't have atomic reactors, like Indiana, as one example, get slammed by all the shipments from the Northeast, the Mid-Atlantic, even from the Southeast, if you can believe it. There are some rail routes from the Southeast that go through the south side of Chicago to get out west. It just happens to be where the train tracks are in this country. And it depends on the company involved. And the risks include severe accidents. As an example, a high temperature, long duration fire that surpasses the design criteria for these containers. And the design criteria for the fire accident scenario is incredibly minimalistic. It's a 30-minute fire that burns at 1,475 degrees Fahrenheit. That's what these shipping containers for irradiated nuclear fuel are designed for. Diesel fuel burns at 1,800 degrees, and real-world fires sometimes, like the Baltimore train tunnel fire in 2001, burned for more than 24 hours at a temperature higher than that design criteria. And if there had been one of these containers in that fire, there was not, but it is a targeted transportation route, so there could have been. Baltimore might have been removed from the map. It may have been so badly contaminated with radioactivity that it wasn't worth the $14 billion to clean it up. Either that or people live there and die in large numbers from cancer at an early age.
Nicole, are you convinced that we should get rid of nuclear energy?
Thank you, Brian. As I have mentioned several times on the show over the past 6 months, yes, I am convinced there are a number of completely, you know, nearly hidden risks and dangers that are just so rarely brought into the mainstream media that are really alarming. I mean, incredibly alarming. And there have been so many near misses that we also, you know, only hear about on this show and on, you know, on Beyond Nuclear's website and on, you know, some alternative media, but that doesn't make it into the broader kind of conversation.
Kevin, I'm going to reveal a secret about Nicole for our audience, which is that she is under the age of 40.
That is accurate.
And the reason that's important is people under the age of 40, and certainly people under the age of 30, won't know what Chernobyl is necessarily, and they won't know what Three Mile Island is. And if they're Americans, they might not remember what Fukushima is. So there isn't the kind of consciousness among younger people who did not experience Chernobyl or were alive and aware and conscious in Chernobyl or Three Mile Island about these profound dangers. And so even though I was being somewhat facetious with Nicole saying, do you now believe that nuclear power is bad? The reason I said that is that in the beginning of this series, when I was talking to Nicole, who is under 40 by a significant number of years, and Walter, also significantly under the age of 40, they were sort of, and they're progressive people, and they're sort of for clean energy, and they kind of weren't sure about nuclear energy because the mythology is that, yeah, maybe there's some risks involved with nuclear energy, but it's a clean fuel alternative, say, to oil or to coal. And again, Kevin, what was Chernobyl?
So Chernobyl happened in April of 1986, April 26th. It was a nuclear power plant with four reactors in Ukraine, but it was immediately upon the border of Belarus, these two Soviet republics. And the Russian nuclear industry really, you know, designed it, built it, ran it. This was Soviet times. And, you know, Gorbachev in his memoir said that the Chernobyl nuclear catastrophe was a major contributor to the downfall of the Soviet Union because it made it clear for everyone in the Soviet Union to see that Soviet leaders, even under Gorbachev, this open transparency guy who wanted reform, There were serious lies told about how bad this disaster was, and it's still considered the worst nuclear power disaster in human history. But it has some competition now, and that is Fukushima, Japan, which began on March 11th, 2011. And we just happened to have a 25th anniversary Chernobyl speaking tour organized at the time because, you know, it was 2011. And we had a preeminent Russian biologist named Alexei Yablokov, who was actually an advisor to Yeltsin during Yeltsin's tenure as leader of Russia. And Yablokov is a longtime anti-nuclear critic of the industry. And he pointed out at the National Press Club on the 25th anniversary of Chernobyl that Fukushima, which had just begun some weeks earlier, would be worse than Chernobyl. And some of the reasons he gave were the population density of Japan. So, you know, Chernobyl was near Kiev, 65 miles away, a major city in Ukraine, the biggest city in Ukraine, downstream of Chernobyl, and they drink the water from the reservoir right next to Chernobyl. So that's serious. But what Yablokov pointed out is with cities greater than a million people like Fukushima City, and then Tokyo, of course, one of the biggest cities on Earth, just 150 miles away, that Fukushima would likely surpass Chernobyl in terms of casualties. And that's pretty significant because Yablokov wrote the book on Chernobyl where he said that from 1986 to 2004, there were close to a million premature deaths associated with Chernobyl.
Yeah. Japan just experienced a typhoon in the last days, last hours, actually. And when I saw the news, I couldn't help but think about Fukushima. Not that this is Fukushima, but it just shows Japan, a country of islands, you know, so impacted by tsunamis, in the case of Fukushima, earthquake and tsunami. The vulnerability just doesn't go away.
Some of the worst days that have happened at Fukushima since the beginning of the nuclear catastrophe have been typhoon-related, because what happens is the wastewater, the radioactive, highly radioactive wastewater stream at Fukushima Daiichi that they're trying to keep contained and keep a lid on, they lose control. And on one of those overflows, they lost an entire 1,000-ton highly radioactive waste storage container. It just overflowed and it flowed into the ocean. So that was one of the worst days in recent years. I think it was in 2013 that happened. So, you know, the typhoons are not helping matters at all. There's a lot of contamination just in the landscape, in the soil, that these floodwaters from the typhoon simply wash out to sea. But then you have actual storage tanks of highly radioactive wastewater where they just overflow because of the weaknesses of their ad hoc system.
I think one interesting part of this, and Brian, you kind of started this thread here talking about people under 40 kind of not having been exposed to these kinds of really big catastrophes. I think part of it too is like because of American exceptionalism, even if you see a really big disaster happening somewhere else, I have to imagine that the average American might not think that that could happen here, right? We have more money, we're stronger, we have a bigger military. That must mean we're spending more on protections. We must be doing this better than the Soviet Union. We must be doing this better than even Japan. But we know that's not true. We know that you can't. There's no doing it better. It's just a dangerous entity. And Kevin, you've talked a lot on the show about a lot of the near misses, and of course we've talked about Three Mile Island. And so I think those things are equally, if not more compelling as well for, you know, reasons why these are just too dangerous to have on our shores or to have on any shores.
Well, we're coming up on the 40th anniversary of Three Mile Island in March of 2019. And we have an event planned in October, October 2nd. It's part of essentially a coast-to-coast speaking tour that's being undertaken by numerous groups, not just Beyond Nuclear. But Beyond Nuclear is going to go to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania on October 2nd, and we're going to have a multifaceted event that day. And part of it is going to be these mobile Chernobyl transportation risks, because the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant wants to ship its waste out west. The Peach Bottom nuclear power plant that's nearby wants to ship its waste out west. Other facets of the discussion will certainly include Three Mile Island because of the upcoming 40th anniversary. Another issue will be my coworker, Paul Gunter, will address the proposal to operate the Peach Bottom nuclear power plant, which is on the Maryland state line in Pennsylvania. It's about 100 miles from here, from Washington, D.C. For not 40 years, the original license, which has already passed, not 60 years, which they already have permission for, but for 80 years. And Peach Bottom is a two-unit still operating Fukushima Daiichi twin design. It's called a General Electric Mark I boiling water reactor. We have dozens of those in the United States, and we have more of the closely related Mark II version. We've seen at Fukushima, Japan, what this reactor design is capable of. You know, in Japan's case, it was a historic earthquake and tsunami. The tsunami wasn't even that big compared to past tsunamis Japan has suffered, but it was enough to cause a triple meltdown. That was another unique thing about Fukushima that Yablokov from Russia pointed out. Chernobyl was one meltdown. It could have spread, but it didn't because of, yes, heroic actions of firefighters and nuclear workers that prevented that.
At Chernobyl, they were rushing. The firefighters were rushing straight at the burning nuclear facility. They all died. Many of them died within days, but they were there to try to prevent that fire from going. It was an amazing level of heroism.
And Fukushima has its heroes, too, who stood by their posts knowing that they would probably die. But at Chernobyl, one of the lesser-known stories is that the turbine haul crew, which was common, I believe, to multiple reactor units, they had flaming nuclear fuel burning through the roof of the turbine haul, landing at their feet. Or maybe it was the carbon moderator. Who knows what it was that was on fire there, but it was highly radioactive. They stood by their posts. They did what needed to be done to prevent the fires from spreading to the other operating units. Or Chernobyl could have been a multi-unit meltdown. Fukushima was. And so this speaking tour is going to not only be in the Midwest. I'm going to be doing that part. Multiple states in the Midwest in September, October, and beyond. We have a Citizens Awareness Network of the Northeast that's doing New England. We've got groups like Public Citizen and the SEED Coalition in Texas who are now fighting this new proposed high-level radioactive waste parking lot dump, as I call them. So these tours are going on in the months coming ahead. And it's like you said, Brian, trying to get the word out there to people who don't know about these issues, that this stuff is coming through your town unless you put a stop to it. And it's for all the wrong reasons. The ultimate driver of this stuff is to transfer the liability for this forever deadly poison called high-level radioactive waste from the companies that profited from its generation onto the public. That's what's really driving these proposals.
That's Kevin Camps. Kevin joins us every Wednesday in a segment called Beyond Nuclear, showing where we stand on this issue, but also the name of his organization, beyondnuclear.org. We talk about nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, nuclear waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States and around the world. We're also joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. Kevin, 40 years ago, Three Mile Island, that's coming up 2019.
March 28th.
March 28th. And, you know, it's really something. The year after Three Mile Island, there was a very large-scale demonstration in Pennsylvania, March 28th, 1980. There was also big protests here in Washington, D.C. The whole area of the mall and the west side of the Capitol was filled up. I can remember organizing buses from New York City, where I lived at the time, to bring people. There was huge, massive protests on Long Island at that time, all around and because of what happened in Three Mile Island. And again, I think people, I just want to take the time, even though sometimes we go over some of the same territory, I think it's worth taking the time to help the current audience, meaning people who might not have been there or even alive at that time, to understand what it is exactly that we're talking about. If Chernobyl is a single meltdown versus a triple meltdown in Fukushima, what does that, of the core, what does that actually mean?
High-level nuclear waste, the irradiated nuclear fuel in the core of the reactors, is ultra-hazardous, even in very small quantities. And so an example is if, let's say, there were an irradiated nuclear fuel rod on the table between us, we would have been dead at the beginning of this program because it takes seconds or minutes for the gamma and neutron radiation coming off to kill you with a fatal dose. Like you said about the Chernobyl firefighters, it may take days or weeks to die. But it's your bone marrow that's dead and can't make new red blood cells. So you're going to die within a couple weeks. So that's why high-level radioactive waste has to be shielded at all times behind very thick radiation shielding. In nuclear power plants, that happens under deep water in storage pools that's chemically treated so that workers don't get fatal doses. They still get doses, but they don't get fatal doses. And, you know, they may get cancer years or decades into the future from their exposures, but they're not going to die on the spot. And then in transport, the radiation shielding is provided by very thick walls on these shipping containers. But the thing is, if you have a severe accident or a terrorist attack, you remove the walls. And now you've got open exposure to this material. So passersby, emergency responders, local residents would be immediately in harm's way. Depends on how big the release is. It could take out a whole region with contamination. And even in storage, you need thick radiation shielding. So it's those dangers of these shipping containers being breached, the storage containers eventually corroding and releasing their contents. These are the things we have to worry about: acute risks in the immediate present, or long-term risks that will extend, if you can wrap your head around this, for millions of years into the future. That's how long high-level radioactive waste will remain hazardous. And it's got to be contained and isolated from the living environment for that whole time. So when, you know, this notion of too cheap to meter nuclear power, inherently safe, well, what are you talking about? Over what time frame? And, you know, an amazing thing is they never accounted for the costs of managing the high-level radioactive wastes. One of our expert witnesses, Dr. Mark Cooper of Vermont Law School, looked into that in 2013, and he determined that for the first 200 years of managing the United States high-level radioactive waste from the commercial industry, his figure was $210 to $350 billion with a B, instantly doubling the generation costs of nuclear electricity. So too cheap to meter just doubled in cost because this externality that had never been accounted for got accounted for. So that's if everything goes smoothly.
Are we producing more or less waste than we were in the United States at the time of Three Mile Island, March 28th, 1979?
Well, the good news is there have been reactor shutdowns. Three Mile Island Unit 2 was shut down by a 50% core meltdown that harmed a large number of people in the area, only officially that was not recognized. And there were settlements out of court with, silencing agreements. The families couldn't talk about
their experience. So non-disclosure agreements.
Yes, non-disclosure agreements with thousands of individuals and families.
Really?
And the good news is that, I mean, the meltdown was not good news, but since then, there have been many shutdowns of reactors. There have been proposed new ones that never got built because the anti-nuclear movement got in the way. And we've got another shutdown coming up in the next couple weeks at Oyster Creek, New Jersey. It's the oldest operating atomic reactor in the United States, another Fukushima twin, and it's 49 years old. And the good news is that when they shut down, you can no longer have a core meltdown once the irradiated fuel comes out of the reactor core, but the danger moves into the storage pool. And the good news, though, is that you're not making more high-level radioactive waste. So as we see more and more reactors shut down, that quantity of waste that's made every year is decreasing. But even now, it's still about 20 metric tons per reactor per year. There's about 100 operating reactors in the U.S. We're talking 2,000 metric tons per year of additional high-level radioactive waste that we don't know what to do with.
And how many, I know there are a lot of storage facilities that you all are fighting back against, Yucca Mountain, for example, but how many storage facilities are already in operation? I mean, it must be a lot.
There are no high-level radioactive waste deep geologic repositories anywhere in the world. There's one in Finland that they are very confident will open in the next few years and operate, but it's for Finland's high-level radioactive waste. They have a handful of reactors there. So it's a very tiny radioactive waste dump. I have my questions about it. It happens to be located immediately adjacent to one of Finland's nuclear power plants. Isn't that convenient? They looked all across Finland for the best geology that could be found to contain this stuff forever. And they looked down at their feet and they found it. It was right beneath their feet. Well, some of the problems with this site, the nuclear plant was built there for cooling water purposes and to get as far away from the capital city as possible in that small country. Well, what about rising sea levels? I'm worried about rising sea levels. I don't know how far above sea level that site is. I should look into it. But, you know, a lot of times, and we're seeing this in Canada at the Bruce Nuclear Power Plant, the biggest nuclear power plant in the world by number of reactors, 9 reactors on one site on the Great Lakes shoreline. They did the same thing. They looked all across Canada, the second biggest country on Earth after Russia. And they found the perfect geology for disposal of radioactive waste right beneath their feet on the nuclear power plant site. Never mind that Lake Huron is 3/4 of a mile away. They're going to, they say only the low and intermediate level radioactive wastes from Ontario, which is 20 reactors. There are other reactors that would ship in, already have been, for interim storage. The truth is they'll probably at some point announce, you know, this is such a good site that we could put the high-level waste here and save all kinds of money.
I mean, all radioactive waste also is dangerous, we should say, right? So, I mean, that's...
So it's on right on Lake Huron.
Yeah, if you look at Michigan and you look at the thumb of Michigan and you go straight east from the tip of the thumb of Michigan, that's about where it is. You can see the Bruce Nuclear Peninsula, the Bruce Peninsula jutting up into Lake Huron, and it's at the base of that peninsula. And, you know, it's outrageous. Another aspect of this particular outrage is that it is the home of the Saugeen Ojibwe Nation. They've had to put up with 9 reactors on their territory for many decades now. All the routine radioactivity releases, the accidental radioactivity releases, and now they're being targeted for at least a provincial radioactive waste dump on their land, if not national.
So, you know, it's the same kind of effects that we're seeing here in the U.S., where the U.S. government is deciding to put nuclear reactors and nuclear waste mostly on native lands.
In the case of New Mexico, there was a previous attempted centralized interim storage facility for high-level radioactive waste targeted directly at the Mescalero Apache Indian Reservation. It was stopped by traditionals like Rufina Marie Laws and Joe Geronimo, who's a descendant of Geronimo. Only now, they've moved it a little bit away. It's still close to the reservation, but now they're targeting Hispanic communities along the Texas-New Mexico borderlands. They want to turn it into a nuclear sacrifice area for the whole country.
And it's interesting, too, when you – I'm just looking at a map of the Great Lakes. I mean, and we're talking about the Great Lakes, Lake Superior, Lake Huron, Lake Michigan, Lake Erie, Lake Ontario. These are the great repositories of fresh water for a big part of North America. I mean, a huge part. And when you look at the maps, because we live in the era of nation states, there's little dotted lines, say, right in the middle of Lake Huron. So Canada's on one side of the dotted line, and the United States is on the other side of the dotted line, but it's one lake. And should anything happen to that lake, it affects everyone who is reliant on drinking water or fishing or commerce or all the other things associated with water. And yet each country can make its own, quote, sovereign decisions about how and where and how to dispose of nuclear waste, for instance. Are there cross-border agencies that are involved in this?
Yeah. The Great Lakes are 21% of the world's surface freshwater, 84% of North America's surface freshwater. It's the drinking water supply for 40 million people in 2 countries, 8 states, 2 provinces, a large number of Native American First Nations. There are cross-border institutions, bodies like the International Joint Commission, which was founded by a 1909 treaty between the United States and Canada. You've also got treaties between the United States and Native American nations. You've got treaties between the Canadian federal government and Canadian First Nations, which do things like protect the fishing rights of these First Nations who have been there since time immemorial. So there's all kinds of laws being violated by these proposals that put the Great Lakes at risk. And we've been fighting that dump for 17 years now, since 2001, since it began as a whisper campaign that the company promoted, Ontario Power Generation. We just held our 4th annual rally by the river, the St. Clair River in Port Huron, Michigan, which is the nearest big city. Port Huron, Michigan, Sarnia, Ontario. It's where Lake Huron flows into the St. Clair River and further downstream. And folks, for now 17 years, have been saying, no way. And we were voices in the wilderness. But just a few years ago, thankfully, it started with a Michigan state senator named Hopgood, who responded to a constituent's call to action and got a unanimous state Senate resolution in Michigan passed against this proposal. That was in 2013, 2014. And since then, we have a growing bicameral, bipartisan U.S. congressional effort to stop this thing. And we're going to have to up the ante, because just last March, the leader of Canada, Justin Trudeau, said that nuclear power was the future of Canada. That was not good news for us, just in the context of this dump fight alone, because it's a recognition that Ontario Power Generation essentially runs the country in more ways than one.
That's the voice of Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the Organization Beyond Nuclear. You can find out about their group by going to the website beyondnuclear.org. We're also joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. Nicole, we have about 4.5 minutes left. Let's go on.
Yeah, let's go on. So there's a new deadline to legally intervene against storage facilities. Do you want to tell us about this new deadline in Texas?
Sure. Well, as we've talked about on the show, we're facing a deadline of September 14th at Holtec, New Mexico, to legally intervene against the proposed mega storage site for high-level radioactive waste. Incredibly, just last week, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission announced not one Goliath that we face, but now a second Goliath that we face at the very same time. Waste control specialists in Texas, another centralized interim storage facility proposal for high-level radioactive waste. The deadlines will be 6 weeks apart. We face an October 29th deadline to legally intervene. And, you know, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is captured by and complicit with and colluding with the nuclear power industry that it's supposed to regulate. So they're doing everything they can to grease the skids for these proposals. And we will show up. We're going to show up in a big way on September 14th. We're going to likewise show up on October 29th. Just one example of this, we faced a July 30th comment deadline on the Holtec New Mexico proposal, and we broke records in terms of the numbers. We generated more than 25,000 comments, and on this subject matter, that's a lot. And that's a part of these speaking tours, is to let folks know in places like New England and the Midwest and the Southeast and other parts of the country that they too live in New Mexico. They too live in Texas. It's in the form of these mobile Chernobyls and floating Fukushimas and dirty bombs on wheels and Three Mile Islands in transit that would come through their town or on the Great Lakes, for example, on Lake Michigan. They want to barge this stuff. So people have to get active and put a stop to it before it starts.
And when you all are kind of pushing back against this, I know that you will have proposed solutions. How is the U.S. government and how are these localities reacting to the solutions that you all are proposing for storage?
I'm glad you brought it up because Citizens Awareness Network in New England, for example, they live in the shadows of these nuclear power plants, even the shutdown ones that have been decommissioned, and they still live in the shadows of the high-level radioactive waste risks on site. They're calling for things, long have been, like hardened on-site storage. Do the on-site storage right, get it out of the pools, get it into fortified containers that are built well and built to last. None of that's happening, not by the companies, not by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And it's got to happen because it's going to take decades to move the waste, even if we had a good site to take it to. It would take decades for it to leave these sites. So we have to protect it where it's at right now.
There's such a clear solution, but why is no one going for this?
Well, the companies do everything they can to boost profits, which means cut costs. And so they take advantage of these pools, for example, keep them full for as long as possible. And that maximizes the risks of a pool fire.
Kevin, we're out of time. Again, we just saw Donald Trump coming out after the protests at the Brett Kavanaugh hearing saying he wishes protests could be banned. Of course he does. But we know that protests and grassroots movements, in fact, are the essence of real democracy. What can people do and how can they do it? How can they get involved with you and with Beyond Nuclear?
Yeah, well, go to our website, beyondnuclear.org, and check out the various sections. There are ways to plug in where you live. There are anti-nuclear groups all over the country. The protests by the anti-nuclear movement in Germany, for example, led to the nuclear phase out. They're going to phase out nuclear power in Germany by 2022, a direct result of grassroots in the streets anti-nuclear protesting.
Yeah, well stated. I mean, nuclear power, like all things in society, are not mandated by some divine power. They are human decisions, and other human decisions could change them and alter policy, change institutions, and free the world from the scourge of nuclear energy, nuclear power, and all the dangers and risks therein. We've been joined in studio by Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. Go to their website at beyondnuclear.org. And we're joined in studio again by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, communitypublicradio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.